The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank, good evening. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. Looking forward to catching up with Bantu Holomisa in just a bit. The UDM leader gagged last year from his probing of issues around Bosasa around the Public Investment Corporation. There's so many of these investigations going on and into the funding of IO Technologies. So we'll chat to him in just a bit, as well as Sam Soul, the senior investigative journalist from Amabungani. And he has done a lot of work on this and being vindicated as the evidence vomits out into the public domain. We'll find out from Ted Blom, who is a partner at Mining and Energy Advisors, as to who's likely to follow Nedbank in withdrawing the funding from the new coal IPPs, the independent power producers. Anything sort of coal in it nowadays is frowned on desperately. We'll talk to Colin Cullis with Business Unusual, Dr. Adrian Saville about the 9 lost years, which Jacob Zuma is very keen for us to forget. And then later on, the managing director and co-owner at Khayelitsha Cookies, her name is Audrey Williams, our shapeshifter.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live, online, smartphones, DSTV, and 92.7 and 106 FM.
Well, the evidence coming out of the Zondo Commission Interstate Capture, the PIC inquiry, on top of the shocking details that emerged from the SARS inquiry, it's depressing a lot of people. It might be useful to treat it as a bit of a catharsis, though. Better out than in. Information in the public domain is far more useful than information hidden away. The PIC Commission today hearing how 4.3 billion rand investment made in IO Technology Solutions was a foregone conclusion. The former chief executive, Dan Machila, allegedly using his authority to overrule concerns inside the PIC about the deal. Suspended PIC assistant portfolio manager Victor Siani telling the commission that rules were bent and broken and how Majila bulldozed the deal through. One of the people watching this with intense interest is investigative reporter Sam Soul, whose reportage last year contributed substantially to the story getting the scrutiny that it is now receiving. Sam Soul, welcome to The Money Show this evening. The testimony, is it connecting many dots for you?
Look, it's very nice that, the reporting that we did last year based on, limited information, not the complete direct inside view that was given today, has proved to be, almost 100% accurate. The decision, at least from the point of view of Victor Siani, and he was, a portfolio advisor, junior person, but the person most directly, intimately involved with looking at IO. This is Iqbal Survey's company. He said very boldly that the decision was a stitch up. It was forced through. His superiors overruled him. They told him what to say. There was no negotiation over the price the PIC paid, which he thought was far too expensive, and so all the things that we wrote and were insulted for by the independent newspapers stable, have been repeated by somebody from within in the PIC, and I hope that the kind of information dam is going to burst now, because you introduced this section by saying, it's better if the information is out there. And that's been our point. We made a presentation last year to the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee to say that the only way that the PIC can survive with any integrity and credibility is if those processes are opened up. It's such a huge pot of money. There's so many people jostling to get their fingers on those levers. The only way that public servants and the public are going to be protected is if we can all see exactly what's going on.
Yeah, and it's a good point. When were you aware of this apparent close friendship between Iqbal Survey and Dan Machila at the time that you were doing your investigations?
Look, the allegations about a relationship have been swirling around. We are not close to Dr. Machida or Dr. Survey, so it was very hard to prove those kind of things. But sources within the PIC insisted that, Dr. Dan, as he's known, was desperate to get these deals through. And we've seen now some detail as to demonstrate that desperation of all the checks and balances and procedures that were just thrown out the window to sign over the money.
This is the real conflict of interest, and this is where the trust issue in the PIC comes through. The idea that the CEO was able to dictate terms to the PIC and that IO was apparently dictating terms to the PIC and not the other way around, on the price of 43 Rand a share, that this price was simply put on the table and was told that's what you will pay for it, leads to the concerns about the valuation. Again, something that you highlighted, 8 months ago?
Yeah, absolutely. It's clear that, there was more, this wasn't a commercially rational deal. There were other reasons for this deal. And what the proposition that we put forward last year, which Mr. Siane basically agreed with in his evidence today, was that IO and Sagamata, which didn't go ahead, were part of a package, a strategy to rescue independent newspapers. Independent newspapers was bought out under the control of the Ipsos Survey with money from the PIC. He's not able to service that loan. So this was going to be a structure and a strategy where more PIC money would be flooded into his businesses, and he would repay that loan, but essentially with the PIC's own money. And it's only, I think, because of the leaks and because of the media reporting last year, that didn't happen.
Has anything surprised you in the testimony? I mean, you see so much extraordinary stuff every day. I think it's hard to surprise you. It's like being the rich guy who can never be surprised by a birthday present or a Christmas present. I mean, because you're surrounded by so much dirt all the time that I find you probably are hard to surprise.
Well, look, It was gratifying that this young black professional came forward and had the courage to say, this is what happened. My superiors used me, and I didn't believe in what I was doing. And hopefully others will now have the same courage to come forward. But I think, what we saw also today was, other allegations coming out about other board members and so on. Which might be regarded as an attempt to deflect attention from this. But we shouldn't discount those allegations. I think the point is that the one I made before, and I really hope the commission grasps this metal. This is such a huge pot of money. It makes some people winners and some people losers in terms of the businesses it supports. It has a huge political impact. We don't want to swap one set of vouchers for another. And at the moment there's counter allegations. It looks like somebody is setting themselves up to be okay. Well, look, I'm the last one standing. I'm the clean one. So now we must carry on before, only with me in charge. And I think that would be a terrible mistake, because the same sort of thing is going to happen.
That's the big risk. Sam Sol, thank you. Senior investigative journalist at Amabungani. General Bantu Olomisa, president of the United Democratic Movement, with us now. Do you feel vindicated, General? You made these allegations 12 months ago, and there were lots of efforts to try and silence you.
Well, it's early days, but we are happy that the PIC investigations is underway, and that even its CEO saw a need to jump the ship early. However, one is concerned that there seems to be a defiance campaign by the board of the PIC, because you can't say you are going to do a parallel investigation or start a parallel investigation process. President Cyril Ramaphosa has appointed a Judicial Commission of Inquiry. If there are serious allegations against any board member or CEO or executive members, the chairperson should refer all those allegations to the current inquiry. So they have suspended people who were supposed to have been given an opportunity to go and be investigated. Why have they been quiet all along and all of a sudden they want to investigate people? It's the same trend which Dan Machil, a former CEO, was doing, where he suspended people whom he suspected that they had leaked the information to the public.
How would you like to see this matter more clearly resolved? I mean, is it time to subpoena Dan Machila to get him to go to the commission? Surely that's unavoidable at this point.
It's still too early for him to go there. Let him relax and swim in his swimming pool and wait. Rather, the commission must deal with all these nauseating exposés which have been in the media all along. Now we are beginning to see a campaign to smear the Deputy Minister of Finance, Monty Kukubele, who is accredited for having been responsible for the inquiry to take place in the first place, because his predecessors were embroiled in funny transactions together with their kicks.
You're referring here to Nhlanhla Nene. Is that your allegation?
Nhlanhla Nene, you talk about the former chairperson of the PIC who wants to be the chairperson of the Harit, which was seated 100% by PIC. I'm talking about Mr. Molekit. All of them.
The dirt seems to be long running and the dirt seems to be deep. Do you have tangible evidence that you will be sharing with the commission as well?
The evidence to be shared with the PIC or the inquiry is contained in the media. What the UDM or myself did was simply to look into these nauseating exposés and wrote a letter to President Cyril Ramaphosa and said, but why are you not active? And of course, when he responded to say there will be an inquiry, so I started to dig deeper. And I'm sure there will be some interesting stories to tell if I happen to testify. I have since requested my attorney or lawyers to ask for us to go and testify in the inquiry. There are certain strategies which I think if we present to the commission itself empowered at the end of the day.
There's a huge amount at stake here. There are billions of rand at stake. Billions of rand in taxpayers' money, billions of rand in pensioners' funds at stake, and also just billions of rands worth of lost opportunities to people who have been fleecing the Public Investment Corporation, it would seem, for a long time. There is a lot riding on this, isn't there?
There's what?
A lot riding on this, lots of vested interests. It's quite a dangerous process to be going through.
There's no dangerous focus here if you are betting on a wicket of promoting ethics of good governance, betting on a wicket of anti-corruption. What is needed here is to ask the management of PIC, give us a list of the unlisted transactions, which you know that they've got a cap of 2 billion without consulting the board. Give us a list of the transactions which were approved by the board. And give us the list of the people who have serviced this money. Secondly, was this PIC funding intended to serve as a bank? Is it known to other people of South Africa, or was it a preserve of the selected few? Why would I go and get a 9 billion in order to buy shares at Steinhoff? And other person is told to go to Standard Bank in order to get secure the same. So there's a lot of things to be hammered out. And we need to have a politician to chair this commission, I mean this PIC. What if those politicians have got a
headquarters
to make sure that some of the asset managers will act as brokers in order to channel money back to the party coffers? Mm.
General, the line quality isn't great, and I thank you for your input this evening. Bantwa Lamisa celebrating, I think, the fact that there is a lot of the dirt that he's been alleging for some time coming out of the woodwork at this inquiry into the Public Investment Corporation. Again, these are allegations. These are untested allegations, but it connects many of the dots that Sam Sol was pointing to 12 months ago already.
EWN Traffic.
In Lynnwood, Pretoria, you can still expect about a 20-minute delay on Lynnwood Road between Rubida and Atterbury. In Centurion, you can also expect some delays on the N14 westbound from the Brakfontein interchange to the R55. In Midrand, there's about a 30-minute delay on New Road between the N1 and Lever. There's also slow-moving traffic between Woodmead and Florida. This is on the N1 south from the Bethune Exchange to 14th Avenue. In Bryanston, there's still bumper-to-bumper traffic on Grosvenor Road approaching the N1 bridge. Traffic is also very slow in Windsor West on Bears No Deer between Judges and the N1. Karabo Jali, EWN Traffic.
EWN Traffic.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Chris Stewart from Investec Asset Management. Private sector credit extension. It's all about how much money swooshing about in the economy. What's it telling us?
Yeah, good evening, Bruce. Yeah, that's a reflection, I guess, of how much people are borrowing. And the good news is people aren't borrowing too much, but the good news as well is that people are at least borrowing a bit. The concern had been after the sort of Black Friday spike and a relatively robust private sector credit extension number for November, we would see that go backwards quite materially. Hasn't really been the case. So whilst credit extension remains modest and borrowing remains modest, largely predicated by the fact that people's ability to service debt is still fairly modest, it's not completely falling off a cliff. So the consumer is active, albeit not hugely so.
Where is the money being spent? It certainly doesn't seem to be being spent as much as perhaps ShopRite would like. At ShopRite Tills, for example.
No, ShopRite had a torrid day today, as you're alluding. They were down sort of in the mid-teens after the close yesterday, releasing what was a very disappointing trading update to the market, talking sales numbers that were probably 10 to 15% below what the market had been anticipating. Sorry, profit numbers 10 to 15% below what the market had been anticipating. That's, I guess, partly as a function of a rough domestic environment, no food price inflation, very competitive environment, some own goals domestically, as they had problems with some of their distribution centers. That meant that they had stock availability issues in South Africa, and they've obviously got a reasonably substantial business elsewhere on the continent, and in Angola in particular, and we all know what's happened to the Angolan currency. That's been devalued over the last year. So the Angolan profits disappearing almost completely. That conspiring to a very disappointing performance from ShopRite in the market, really voting with their feet on that stock today.
And taking the rest of the retail sector with it as well. I mean, retail generally has been blimmin' awful in terms of the updates that we've seen coming from these retailers. And sort of everyone constantly seems to be taken by surprise that the news flow is bad. Maybe it's just they're not anticipating how bad it actually is.
Yeah, I think it was two Wednesdays ago we were speculating as to whether the reasonably robust performance in retail stocks year to date would be sustained.
Well, now we know the answer.
Once the facts started to come out, and we, I think at the time, speculated that it was very unlikely that retail trading updates were going to be positive, and they've been horrible, I think is the best way to describe them. Considerably worse than the market had been anticipating. That's indicative of a lot of pressure on the consumer. And, you know, we've seen those stocks retracing sharply. And with ShopRite going backwards today, it dragged most of the sector with it, too.
Although, I mean, if there was an outlier, it was possibly Lewis. Maybe Lewis was coming from such a low base after having its own 5 years of hell. Perhaps that's why it is the least ugly at the ugly party.
Yeah, tallest dwarf, if you like. Let's contextualize that. As you indicate, Lewis has had a torrid time of it the last few years with the National Credit Act compromising its traditional sort of financial services model dressed up as selling furniture. That's unraveled quite sharply on it over the last number of years. Reporting what was a reasonable trading update for the third quarter of their financial year. That's the quarter ending end of December last year. They did make a fairly major acquisition of United Furniture Outlets, or UFO, and that has really bolstered the sales numbers. So you've really got to isolate the traditional business from the new acquired business to get a sense of whether there is any growth in that franchise. And the good news, I guess, is that if you take UFO into account, it's quite robust. Outside of that, it was okay, not great. Their financial services side of their business, or the non-furniture merchandising side of the business, still under a lot of pressure, but at least stabilizing at much, much lower levels than previous years. And, you know, the UFO business, which operates in a slightly higher LSM, doing a little bit better. And I think that's a trend we're seeing across the board. Brands within companies that are servicing the higher-end LSMs doing a little bit better than the brand servicing the lower LSMs. It's really amongst those lower LSMs that the consumer pressure is being felt the most.
And it couldn't be clearer, that point, if you look at the breakdown of Spurs trading update today. Spurs Steak Ranches grew at 6%. Panarotti's down by 1.5%. John Dory's down. But the Hussar Grill growing at 14% almost, outstripping Rocco Mamas, outstripping all of the rest of the divisions within Spur Steak Ranches, the overall Spur group.
Yeah, that's quite right, Bruce. I mean, that's exactly the point I was alluding to. That's that the you know, both in the case of Lewis and in the case of Spur, you've seen the higher LSM franchises doing a lot better than the lower LSM franchises. All those numbers within Spur are, if you like, not like for like. In other words, there's new outlets included in those numbers. But even if you look at the same store sales growth, if you can use that analogy for a business such as Spur, the Hussar Grill has materially outstripped the peers, and that is probably as a function of the fact that that is of appeal to a slightly higher income group. The other interesting trend, I think, to emerge from the Spur results is the fact that, you know, they've just released their sales numbers for the first 6 months of their financial year. That's the last 6 months of last year from a calendar perspective. And it's very, very evident that the last quarter, in other words, the period October, November, December, was considerably weaker than the quarter before that. And that really ties in with the disappointing performance we've seen from the retailers over the last quarter of last year. Consumers really not going out and spending.
And doesn't bode brilliantly for this year, does it, from a growth perspective? Because if nobody's spending any money and people are sitting on their cash, where does the growth come from?
Yeah, I think to make an optimistic story for consumer-facing South African stocks, you've either got to say, well, you know, the valuations are quite compelling, therefore the market's expectations are quite low. That didn't do you very well the last few weeks from the retail sector.
No.
Or you've got to say that markets are forward-looking and things are going to get better. Let's get this election behind us. Let's get a little bit more confidence out there. Perhaps corporates start employing, consumers start gearing up a little bit, financial services providers are comfortable to lend a little bit more, and we see a recovery. The danger in that, I guess, is that, again, the timing of that recovery is longer dated than we're expecting, and the magnitude of that recovery may be a little bit less. Nobody's going out on a limb and saying that we're going to see a fantastic recovery in economic growth. We're going to drift along this year. We may have a better second half than the first half, maybe a little bit more growth next year. But the fact is, you know, I would caution against expecting too much, because it doesn't look as though that's going to happen.
Chris Stewart from Investec Asset Management, thank you.
702. SMS Bruce on 31702.
I'm glad to see Nikki Newton-King at the JSE warning about the impact of policy uncertainty on long-term investing. She's saying that the debates, while they're important, she's cautioning against the use of what she calls extreme language in the run-up to elections. And there's a great quote from her, and it says, "What investors are very worried about is our general propensity as a country to be long on discussion in policy, long on various forms of policy, but very short on execution and very short on coherence between policies. Yep, she's absolutely spot on the mark on that one, Nikki Newton-King at the JSE. Well, an organization calling itself the Please Call Me movement plan to picket and maybe even invade Vodacom World tomorrow. It wants Vodacom to pay 70 billion rand to Nkosana Makate, who the Constitutional Court found had invented the Please Call Me service while he worked at Vodacom. It left the quantum, though, of the settlement to negotiation, and if that failed, then to the CEO. And Vodacom a couple of weeks ago said it had reached a settlement. Makate described the offer as an insult. He rejected it. Duncan McLeod, the editor of Tech Central, have you ever seen a showdown like this, which has got the mix of corporate skullduggery and dishonesty, the wounded David versus the Goliath, and meddlesome politicians getting in the middle of it?
That's right, Bruce. It's a bit of a mess, isn't it? I see Vodacom has said they're not going to open Vodacom World tomorrow. It's going to be closed. So I'm not sure who's going to be there to greet the protesters when they arrive at Vodacom World, assuming they do. But Vodacom taking the precaution of shutting down the entire Vodacom World superstore, which no doubt is going to have an impact on the businesses that operate out of there.
Yeah, it will. I mean, what's your take on the standoff between Mr. Makate and Vodacom? He feels hard done by. Vodacom says it's doing the best it can under the circumstances for a service they don't deny he did deliver, and you know, they do acknowledge that a payment was promised, but they just have a completely different idea of the quantum.
Indeed, and I guess my guess is that Makate has racked up some very large legal fees. You know, he's been running this this court battle for over a decade. It's I think he first made the claims to this about 18 years ago. So it's been going on for a very long time. Worked its way all its way up to the Constitutional Court, and no doubt the lawyers that are backing him want their pound of flesh now. And while we don't know what the quantum is that Vodacom has offered him, because there's a confidentiality clause that both parties have agreed to, I would imagine that a large portion of that settlement money, if not all of it, will go to Makate's lawyers.
And I know the Constitutional Court used the term he's the inventor and that he created this thing, but there are counterclaims, and we've heard these claims before, and they've resurfaced once again, that actually MTN trademarked or at least patented something very, very similar even before Makate took it to Alan, not Craig, at Vodacom.
Yes, that's correct. MTN, there was a chap called Ari Khan who was a contractor to MTN at the time. And I've seen the paper trail and the documents, and he patented it before Vodacom did. MTN never seemed to enforce that patent. I think they did send Vodacom a snotty letter at one point saying, actually, we invented this and we own the patents. But I don't believe it ever got to court. I'm not sure why MTN decided not to enforce that patent. But it would appear to me that that Makate and Khan came up with this idea at round about the same time and independently of each other. MTN was the company that had the foresight to file for the patent.
Does this change Makate's case at all or not?
Not at this stage, no, because the Constitutional Court has already found in his favour.
Are you going to take a little drive past Vodacom World tomorrow? Are you going to keep tabs on this?
I might do. Well, given that the store's closed, I'm not sure how much is going to be happening there, but I may indeed grab my camera and head past there and see what's happening.
Old-fashioned reporting. Look at that in the digital age. Duncan McLeod, editor at techcentral.co.za, website for everything to do with technology and all of the stories, of course, in the world of technology on techcentral.co.za. Thank you, Duncan McLeod. Colin Cullis with Business Unusual coming up after Eyewitness News. The data that will either support or negate President Jacob, or former President, it's hard to get to the, remember the former bit, former President Jacob Zuma's rebuttal that to the comments of Tito Mboweni and Cyril Ramaphosa recently that South Africa suffered a lost 9 years in terms of economic opportunity. So we've got economist Adrian Saville crunching the numbers to see who is right in the battle of opinions as to whether or not we had a great or not so great 9 years. Anecdotally, I kind of think I know where he's going to go with this, but it'll be good to have the facts.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702. For the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank, good evening. Welcome to The Money Show. South Africa, 155 for three, targeting 244. 244, and they're going on at a decent pace. It doesn't look like they 241 is the target, I beg your pardon. The final one-day international between South Africa and Pakistan happening at Newlands. South Africa look like it is a slam dunk, but it's a strange old game. We watch the space and keep you up to speed with what's happening in the cricket. The EU leaders today wasting no time. They've rejected Theresa May's call to reopen talks on Brexit. This divorce deal is getting messy. It's like the real world. It comes after the Parliament, the UK Parliament last night, voted in favour of scrapping the Irish backstop. And there's very little hope that Theresa May will get her deal through the House of Commons unless the backstop is changed or removed altogether. It's, I mean, a big big problem for Theresa May. It's a big problem for the UK, which is facing leaving the European Union without a deal as to how they are going to run their lives in future. And it's potentially devastating for the UK economy. It's deadly serious, and there's games of brinkmanship seriously underway. So all of that is under a huge amount of pressure at the moment. Colin Cullis now with Business Unusual standing by.
The Money Show.
Business Unusual with Colin Cullis.
Business Unusual brought to you by SAP. Myths about SAP software have been busted. Keep listening to hear why the best run SAP. Tell me about mushrooms and milkmen and packaging and waste. Colin Cullis.
Bruce, our story begins in the 60s. That's when plastics was the buzzword. In fact, the movie The Graduate in 1967 had the line that said, "I have just one word for you, plastics." It was thought it was going to solve everything. It was like the high-tech wonder thing. And since then, it pretty much has gone on to be used for everything. In fact, if you put your arm out, I'm willing to bet you'll touch something made of plastic. And just about anybody who's listening, put your arm out. I'm willing to bet you will touch something made
all of plastic. See, we had computer, microphone, buttons, desk is plasticky, pen, face. Yeah.
So the challenge, though, is that because it's getting, you know, so ubiquitous, it's so cheap, we are using it for more and more marginal things. And the problem is the stuff that we can effectively call instant rubbish, single-use plastics. The stuff that was created that as soon as we touch it, we effectively say, well, now it just needs to be thrown away. And so this evening I'm looking to look at some of the alternatives to that, because while South Africa is sort of mid-table for the country's waste and dealing with landfill issues, developed economies have a huge problem with this. And as we hope to see ourselves develop, well, we will start seeing similar issues. So if we can avoid that, that would be great. But it's not an easy thing to fix. One option, for example, is for us to go back to a time before we used plastic for all of these things. But given the time that's passed, two generations, we've grown up with this stuff. It's going to make it very hard for us to give up. And it's not to say that plastic is inherently bad. Plastics for packaging have made food waste less. It helps from the, you know, when you're harvesting and you're packaging, you're transporting, you're storing it, and you're displaying it. That all works because anything there that's used can always be returned to a supply and reused. It's the bit that when we pick it up as consumers and take it home that it becomes a challenge. One, we don't have any need of it. Returning it back to the actual retailer is a bit of a schlep, and generally we probably don't really care about doing that. So there are some companies who are looking to kind of find an alternative, and I want to mention some of those too, because we have some already here in South Africa. The plan is you bring your own container, or they will deliver and bring it, you know, you return the container back to you. So the two I'm aware of here in Cape Town is Shop Zero and Nude Food. And I understand there's a couple more sort of in underway being opened. I understand there's one soon to be opened in Johannesburg. There's a couple in KZN.
We had Nude Food as a shapeshifter once. And, I mean, it's a huge schlep running a packaging-free retail business, because most of us are so bloomin' spoiled, we don't give two thoughts to our packaging and stuff. We might go and if you go to Woolies or whatever, you might complain dreadfully that, you know, everything comes in plastic, but doesn't it look nice? You know, it really is hard to break that cycle. It takes a big commitment. It really does.
Absolutely right. And you know, one thing, I was chatting to one of those retailers today, and the issue sometimes is, you know, you bring your own container. I hope you kept that container nice and clean. I hope it's an appropriate container for you to use. We sometimes just don't know well enough, despite the well-intentioned thing of bringing your own container, that it could come with other issues. And this is where the milkman comes back in, which I'm pretty sure is hardly the correct term anymore, but this is a 200-year-old service. I didn't realize it had been going that far back, where dairies had been, you know, delivering you milk every day and taking back your old empty bottles. And this is the principle they want to do. In fact, there was a small little flurry around it in Davos last week, with one company called Loop being a bit of a startup that actually wants to start making the service. They've started with a couple of retailers, quite big names, but only a small couple of products. Then when you order them, they will arrive in a reusable container. And then when you need them refilled, the containers will be collected, and you'll receive new ones, but then those will constantly be reused. So, you know, glass bottles is the one that we certainly still do use, and expanding that out. So where you used to use plastic bottles, I know they're using a shampoo that'll come in an aluminium container, you know, little canisters, all these other sort of things. Jars, I'm sure, will be a big part. And they'll come and pick it up and take it back. That's at least a little less of a schlep. You're going to get your container, and it will get delivered to you. And again, Shop Zero does that once a week here in Cape Town at the moment. I don't know that it's a huge service. It is still quite quite expensive comparative to just wandering in and getting yourself. So it is probably still those people, one, who have the means to do it and really feel quite strongly that they want to be part of changing something. Unfortunately, the majority of us, we're not there yet. And so the challenge is going to be how to do it. And in fact, to try and get some sense about that, because while, you know, we're starting to feel a little better about doing our recycling, we're not necessarily always that good at what it means. So I asked the poll ahead of the show, do you know what the numbers mean inside the recycling logo? And I gave you four options. Yes, it denotes the number of reuses you can use for that piece of plastic. Yes, it refers to the type of plastic being used. No, but you've always wondered. Or no, you haven't even noticed.
Four.
What do you think the most? Yeah, okay. 40% of people said they hadn't even noticed there was the number there, and I count myself included in that.
Yeah, I mean, I put my hand up, I confess, I admit it.
But I must say, the curious 702 Cape Talk listeners, 31% said no, but they have wondered, and 21% got it right. It's that number refers to the kind of plastic that it's made out of. So one is the most common one, not because that's the one that says the one, is PET. I'm tempted to try and say
petro-electro-tetrocarbons or something along those lines.
Yeah, I'm not going to say it. You're quite right, because I'll just mess it up. PET. And the thing with that one is it can absolutely be recycled. We should definitely recycle it, but they do caution, don't reuse it too often. This is the one there. Some of the bits can sort of leach out, so it should be recycled but not reused. Others reuse, don't recycle, and it's not because it can't be recycled, just that in the act of recycling, we either don't get enough of it collected together in a general sort of return cycle, or there aren't that many uses that in South Africa warrant recycling it, as opposed to just making the stuff fresh for when you need it. And there isn't an economic amount that needs to be calculated with. This is not just, it's good for the environment, therefore just do it. We need to find that balance. And that's kind of one of the challenges where it comes from. But sometimes you do get some people who just allow this movement to get a sort of an extra little impetus, because invariably there's a lot of people pushing from a lot of different directions to try and get us to do this. And you probably remember the sort of line, reduce, reuse, recycle. That's kind of the general line we know for recycling.
There's even a lovely kids song about it from, I forget the movie, but Jack Johnson, reduce, reuse, recycle. I could sing it to you, but then we'd have no listeners left.
I will look that up. Bea Johnson is one of those activists, and she's added two more words, refuse, reduce.
Ooh.
Reuse, recycle, and rot. So refuse, of course, is saying if it's a single-use plastic, just refuse it. If you can do away or if you can do without it, please do. Very, very noble, and hopefully you can do it. But my second part, the mushroom thing, refers to that rot bit, because there is still a lot of packaging that we absolutely have to have. When you buy something, your new phone, you don't want it to just be handed to you. You want it to come in something. But that thing is kind of, again, instant rubbish. You take the phone out, you never need the box again, really. Although some people hang on to boxes for a variety of reasons. So this crowd, back in sort of 2007, and even before that, the creator inventor had noted when he was looking after some old bales of straw on the farm, that mushroom mycelium, you know, the little fungus, would grow in amongst the straw and then sort of bind it all together. He didn't really think too much about it, but in thinking with plastics, and it's amazing how sometimes people make these weird connections, he said, I wonder if I could make a packaging material using the mycelium in some other growth medium. So what they've done is they take molds, that the molds in the shape of the things you're going to need to hold your phone or your computer or furniture or whatever it is you need to have packaging in, the same way you use sort of polystyrene, and then they put it in some old agricultural waste. They use like old wheat husk, stuff that we're not going to eat and don't really want to feed to animals. You would just use for recycling anyway. And they put this in the mold, and they add their special strand of mushroom mycelium. It takes 6 days for the thing to grow, 2 days for it to sort of dry out, and then you're ready. You've got your new packaging. And depending on what you need to do with that packaging, As soon as you're done with it, you toss it in your garden or your compost or whatever else. It takes about a month and it'll be gone. In fact, a lot of times they're handing it at flower, you know, when you give away seeds and things like that. You just stick it in there, stick that in the ground, the plant will grow and you get rid of it altogether. There is even somebody, because they're sort of encouraging an ecosystem, as it were, of people who can use this stuff. For a person who said, I want to make a lamp, like an organic lamp. And they said, okay, we'll grow you a lampshade. And not only did the lampshade look kind of cool, they actually made one that looks like a mushroom. One hotel chain said, it'll be very cool for us to be seen to having these things. And they ordered 130 of them. And that became a bit of a thing. So the opportunity isn't just that it can replace some of the sort of the packaging, but there's a great opportunity for marketers to say, people might be attracted to it, not just because it's the right thing, because it'll look good as well. And I think that's the real wonderful bit about it. It's also a fantastic industry. Anybody can really get into a low-tech, let's grow some mushroom things. And if I understand that there isn't a license yet in South Africa for somebody looking to do it. So a potential for somebody to get in on the ground floor and do something with that as well. I hope, though, that while this seems quite unlikely, we're going to get it done now. Perhaps in sort of 20 or 30 years' time, we'll look back at it. And this will be the crazy time when we used single-use plastics and we didn't use milkmen for that little period.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, I look at it and saying, oh, good, maybe we'll disrupt 3D printing, because 3D printing is all about plastics and stuff. And if we can get the mushroom thing going, then mushrooms can disrupt 3D printing. That would be cool.
Yeah, that's effectively what it potentially can do. And I'm mindful sometimes we talk about one thing killing another or one thing replaces another. It never really does. It sort of augments or adds it in. So plastics are fantastically useful. We don't want to get rid of them. But where we've started using them foolishly, where we haven't worked out a way to properly get rid of them, pull them out of the waste chain, that's where we need an intervention. And here, a very low-tech solution, a very old solution, might be just the thing we need.
We're in agreement. My thanks to Colin Cullis this evening with Business Unusual. There's an old cliche that says you never get a second chance to make a first impression. The reality is myths and perceptions can be notoriously hard to change. For instance, SAP is not just for large enterprise. Over 80% of SAP's customers are mid-sized businesses. SAP has solutions for any size of business and offers technologies like artificial intelligence, machine learning, IoT. It's also got solutions from HR to citizen engagement and digital supply chain across all industries. Visit asksap.co.za to find out why the best run SAP.
Money Show.
The Big Five.
The Big Five tonight needs to do some myth busting, because we need to try and figure out who's right and who's wrong in a particular debate. Big Five brought to you by Worksman's Attorneys, your legal specialist for success for the last century, keeping you close for 100 years. Visit worksmans.com. Now, the former President Jacob Zuma pushing back quite hard against the assertion that South Africa has had a lost decade under his leadership. These assertions being referred to by the President, Cyril Ramaphosa, and the Finance Minister, Tito Mboweni, as well. And Jacob Zuma went to his Twitter feed yesterday and got some headlines this morning about pushing back and saying, lost decade? Moi? Me? So we've asked the Cannon Asset Management Chief Executive, Dr. Adrian Saville, to define the big five things South Africa has lost over the last 9, 10 years. He can pick whether it's a full decade or not. And after that, you can decide on balance whether or not South Africa is better off now than it was a decade ago. To be fair to the Zuma administration, one of the great breakthroughs one of the great issues they corrected after the years of Mbeki denialism around the connection between HIV and AIDS and the potential cures for HIV and AIDS and the medication around it was the rollout of antiretrovirus. So you get a big fat star for that one, Jacob Zuma. But as for the rest, Dr. Adrian Saville, I wonder, he's chief executive of Cannon Asset Managers. We're all poorer after a decade of Jacob Zuma, aren't we?
Yeah, indeed, Bruce. I think one of the big losses is that rewind 10 years, South Africa's per person income was about $6,000, roughly in line with world per capita income. And from then to now, world per person income has risen by about 20%. And South Africa's per person income is effectively flat, which means the world has advanced 20 and we've stood still. So on a relative basis, we're 20% behind versus being evenly matched 10 years ago.
In real terms, we haven't stood still. We're poorer because of inflation. Inflation has eroded the value of our money. If we've stood still, we've gone backwards, surely.
Yeah, you're allowed to be a little bit dejected, but not that bad, Bruce, because adjusting for inflation, we are level pegging.
Okay, all right, just checking. I want to be dejected. I don't want to be depressed. Dejected is about as far as I'm prepared to go. I mean, things like the credit rating, which so many people just don't appreciate the importance of, the fact that we were on a very solid credit rating footing at the end of the Mbeki era, and it has gradually been corroded to practically junk.
Yeah, you know, to use a very poor footballing analogy, this time 10 years ago, we were going into the Football World Cup. The mood was euphoric. Moody's agreed with the mood, and Moody's had us on an A grade. So our paper was of the highest class amongst emerging markets. And the other two major ratings agencies were just a step off the pace. They had us right at the top of the of B grade. From then to now, we have steadily slipped down the ratings agency scales. And as you know, by measured by foreign credit rating, we are in sub-investment grade. And just a step away from sub-investment grade on domestic debt. And that's largely explained at the headline level by a steady increase in government indebtedness. 10 years ago, 25% government debt to GDP. Today, 50% debt to GDP.
And not much to show for it, unfortunately. It's been so much of it has been misappropriated, stolen, and misused.
Unfortunately, there is nothing to show for the debt in terms of improvements in infrastructure, physical infrastructure in particular, which is so critical to achieving inclusive and elevated growth. So, yeah, you know, it's effectively that we have borrowed, as if we have borrowed to pay for a holiday. We've had, and the pun's not intended here, a 10-year economic holiday, and we've got the debt, we've spent the money, and we don't have the investment results to show for it.
We don't, and we're not very relaxed either. I mean, again, Eskom is almost, I suppose, a symbol of the shambles. If you look, look at that.
Yeah, you know, you say we've got nothing to show for it. I'm afraid we do have some things to show for it. I think a state-owned enterprise that really raises many, many red flags. So Eskom, I think, I would argue, is one of the biggest risks facing the South African economy in 2019, not just from a fiscal status and a capital market status, Eskom bonds and the drain on treasury, but from an operating perspective. There's business risk, there's investment risk in this. So it really is something to be alarmed about, that we've spent all of this money. Believe it or not, hold your breath. 10 years ago, Eskom was profitable, and it had came off the back of 10 years of profitability. That's where we were 10 years ago.
Yeah, I'm still holding my breath.
you can breathe again.
And here's the problem: is that in the undermining of this confidence, and it's a slow erosion. Public confidence in the way in which the economy is being managed, concerns about the future, have eroded things like tax morality, have eroded compliance, have eroded corporate morality, have eroded the desire to invest in the South African environment. Generally, we've lost confidence in ourselves. And if there is one, call it a crime, that has been committed over the last decade, it is the destruction of national self-confidence.
Yeah, and I think underneath that confidence, Bruce, the loss of fabric and cohesion and trust. So let's go back those 10 years, and we had the euphoric vuvuzela mood up against Mexico. We managed to get a goal. And from then to now, it's been a series of own goals. It's hard to find the social, the economic, the institutional evidence that that former President Zuma is pointing to. It simply isn't there. It has been lost.
Are economies able to drag themselves out of the treacle-like morass that they create for themselves over a period like 10 years?
You know, 10 years is a long time, and it starts to seep from being, you know, cyclical and passing and transient to actually becoming part of your mindset, part of your mentality, part of your behavior, part of your beliefs, and resident in the physical, not just the intangible sort of architecture of the economy. So these are, you know, hard times. I think there is an argument that could be made that it is hard times that create sort of resilience and rebound. And very often it is the case that economies have to be put under pressure, or societies have to be put under pressure to find the collective. If there is a time, I think it is now. And there are numerous economies, numerous examples we can point to of countries, economies, societies that have pulled themselves up from tough places, and they, you know, wide ranging. Latin American economies in the 1980s and 90s, Southeast Asian economies in the 90s and noughties. South Korea is a great recent example. Junk grade, deep financial crisis in 1998. Samsung, Hyundai, and Kia today.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible, but boy, it's hard. And
it's hard.
Are we making, is our national catharsis, otherwise known as scores of inquiries and investigations into wrongdoing? I mean, it's one way of doing it, I suppose, to get the information out into the public domain. But unless we choose to aggressively tackle the evidence that we assemble, we go back to square one.
Yeah, the word that you use is tackle, you know, which infers action.
Mm.
Demosthenes, the great Athenian orator, said, you know, the result of one of his great talks, he knew if it was effective if he saw three things: action, action, and action. And, you know, without turning those thoughts, arguments, ideas, plans into action, it really is just a book review.
Yeah, that is much, very, very true. Dr. Adrian Saville, Chief Executive at Cannon Asset Managers, thank you very much indeed. A depressing look. I'm sorry it's depressing, but we got to come to terms with the fact that that's the brutal reality in which we live, and that's the environment in which we are in, and it is as a result of failed governance. It's a failure of the state to do its job, and I'm afraid Jacob Zuma, who will object to this, who's objected to Cyril Ramaphosa and Tito Mboweni's assessment of the situation. But it was on your watch, big guy, that South Africa got itself into this big mess.
The Money Show is brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank. The Money Show.
Shapeshifters. Now, there's a hotel that I stay at in Cape Town sometimes that has Khayelitsha cookies in the rooms. And it's very nice. You get a little biscuit with your tea, and they're very nice. Crunchy, ginger, usually. I'm delighted to see that they've expanded the repertoire, the range of Khayelitsha cookies, because baking a biscuit's not a complicated thing. It's a bit of flour, it's a bit of flavoring, and it's a bit of butter. Mix them all together and pound them into a shape, chuck them in the oven, and you get a biscuit. I don't mean to oversimplify it, but Audrey Williams is looking at me as if I've just said rude things about her favorite pet. Audrey, you own Khayelitsha cookies. How did this adventure start?
Thank you very much, Bruce. It started in 2005 at the Nubuntu Training Center in Khayelitsha.
This is before you get involved.
That's before me. Okay. I joined in 2007.
Right.
Where an American lady started training up unskilled ladies in Khayelitsha how to hand bake and hand bake cookies with donations they received from flour, like you said, flour, butter, sugar. And then the sponsorships ran dry, and they had to start walking with baskets in town to sell the cookies to afford more raw ingredients to train up more people. And still till today, that's how we function. So I joined the business in 2007, gave up my career at a large corporate.
What were you doing before you did this? Because this is an important bit of context.
I basically trained up baristas, so I come from a coffee background.
Right.
So I was in sales and marketing in the coffee industry. And, yeah, I did very well for myself at a very young age. and basically left the corporate world. And the day I walked into Khayelitsha Cookies, I just realized that this is my passion. This is my future.
What got you there?
It was four ladies, three normal little tables, three house ovens. And when I walked in, I saw a future of 1,000 ladies plus baking. And still till today, that is the dream that I'm chasing. And we know that every lady we employ basically looks after 5 to 7 dependents every night. So for us, we measure success in numbers and how many people we employ.
How did you come get in touch with Khayelitsha Cookies? I mean, who made the connection between you and a business that was heavily indebted and on the verge of shutting down?
Well, I basically got tired for the, like in my industry, in the training up the baristas, very long working hours. And basically started applying for jobs online and in newspapers. And the day that I was on my way to go and sign a contract with a new company, I got the call from Khayelitsha Cookies to say, come in for an interview.
Now, I mean, that sounds like a far more formal business than I would have anticipated Khayelitsha Cookies to be.
Yes. and it was.
Explain.
So basically, I mean, you walked into this factory that wasn't food safe as yet. As I said, literally like walking into your own home kitchen. And most days we wouldn't even have any baking to do. So the ladies would arrive for work. They would actually go back home again. And I looked back at the ordering books the other day and we rejoiced when we had like 1,000 cookies that we had to bake, because then it was like a phenomenal day in our lives. So, and it took some work to actually grow it to where it is today.
How much trouble was Khayelitsha Cookies in at the time?
Huge problems. So I worked for them until 2013, when the two directors called me into office, gave me a box of tissues and told me that we employed just under 50 people then, that the business needs to close down. And we were indebted with 2.5 million rand. And the net asset value of the business was only 100,000 rand. And that is where I went home and I prayed, and my husband prayed with me, and God gave me a verse in Leviticus 26 verse 10, where I knew that I need to offer.
I'm going to test
rand.
You on this one. What does Leviticus 10 say?
You will be a blessing to others out of your overflow.
Oh, all right.
And yes, and I mean, that was a big problem or promise for a business that doesn't have anything to give.
How did the directors, and without, I mean, again, with all the best intentions in the world, debt is a terribly easy thing to rack up. But how did they rack up that much debt in such a tiny enterprise?
What takes us 40 days to bake, 40, takes a machine 1 day. And people were not prepared to pay more for a hand-baked cookie than a machine-baked cookie. And to also get the facility food safety accredited, there was huge amounts that we had to invest in the business to get it to a point where we could start supplying the Nestle's and the Purities and the Clixes in life. And that's basically why we ended up with so much debt. It's that first 5 years where you really grow the business. That was the main reason behind it. And everybody told me that I've lost my marbles and I should get booked into a institution for offering them 1 rand for the business and taking over 2.5 million rand debt for a business that was worth 100,000 rand in net asset value.
Now, so, is that after your night of prayer, you go home to your husband, and which one of you bright sparks came up with the idea of offering a rand for the business? Because now you're overcome by faith, of course.
Exactly. And the bright spark was me. And my husband is still bald till today after that decision.
you offered a rand for a business with 2.5 million rands worth of liabilities. You took on the livelihoods of 50 women who between them would have 250 dependents. And you set about driving a turnaround.
Yes. And the turnaround for us came really with my fellow director, Eunice, and our management team. And we decided, look, the only way we're going to beat this is we actually need to start manufacturing like a machine would, but by using manual labor. So we spend a lot of time in the factory actually streamlining the processes and working on our productivity to turn the business around. And that is truly, honestly, in the first year, we started making profit. And since then, we've been paying back debt. So we've also gone through a relocation lately, where the business suffered some losses again because it was a huge capital investment that we had to do. But again, we're starting to turn the business around. And I mean, with a business, we currently function on 0.01% profit margins. So most people will tell you, get out of that business. Why are you still in the business? You're insane.
Yeah.
And the long and short is when you walk into that factory and you see the woman and you see how they've started, you know, like a learning in life and how they look after their children and the pride that they've developed and putting their children through school and knowing that their children do not form part of the statistics of 64% of South African children not reaching the age of 5 years due to malnutrition, then it makes it worth it to manage. It makes it worth it to run.
But how sustainable are you? Because you don't have any margin for error. I mean, something bad goes wrong.
Yes.
It's tickets.
It's tickets. And we experienced that basically in April because we relocated. And literally 2 days after we were in our new facility, we had a flood because the builder messed up with the roof. And it's a property that we're renting. And it used to be an old building that burned down and they rebuilt it newly. And the builder never fixed the gutters properly. And we literally had a flood from the roof over our ovens, over the DV boards, the architect, and we lost, we're still down 4 ovens as we speak. And I mean, each oven is like 320,000 rand. So, you know, it's not very easy to try and recoup that again. But I think with passion, with determination, with mentors in the industry, and knowing that you're truly making a difference in people's lives, it's the driving force behind keeping this business going. And we've seen it with our management team. They are absolutely so passionate and committed that we work until some nights, if we know huge orders needs to go out, we work until 9 o'clock, the whole team. You know, and we do it with a smile on our faces because we know that that's what we need to do to actually continue trading the next day. And what we've realized now is we need to start focusing on exporting because the export market is more geared for paying a higher premium on the products that we do because they understand the social entrepreneurial aspect and the social upliftment of what we're doing, where the South African economy and the South African consumer doesn't appreciate that much yet because we got conditioned to the situations we face in South Africa.
I mean, I watched a video of your production process and you're not quick.
No.
No, but I mean, as a team, it's not possible to have massive production lines and be producing 10,000 biscuits an hour or whatever an industry standard might be. It's because of the nature of the labor intensivity of it, your purpose being employment and opportunity for people who otherwise wouldn't have opportunity.
Yes.
You choose to take an old school approach to producing your biscuits, which is lovely and noble, but not efficient.
Correct. And I've been challenged on this quite a bit. So what you will see in our new factory is part of the production lines of our large key clients that doesn't necessarily want the product packed by hand. And they don't mind it going through a flow wrapper to actually, you know, like increase production capacity and speed that we can utilize that labor again in producing more cookies. We introduced a flow wrapper. So it's our first sort of mechanized piece of machinery that we've got in the factory. And we also bought the entry-level one, you know, and we trained up the ladies. And without us knowing, it was also setting a new precedent in the industry because I dare someone to phone me and tell me that they've got a lady managing a flow wrapper. You do not get flow wrapper operators that are women. So, yeah, we got quite clued up with our little toolboxes and you know, like opening up the machine and getting it sorted. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, so we know and we realize that it needs to be this balance. It needs to be a fine balance between productivity, keeping the core of our ethos in keeping things as manual as possible, but also where possible, introduce the slightly more mechanized. But even now, we had to develop a pneumatic dough divider to portion the products correctly. You know, to eliminate waste at the end of the day. And we have to. We can't buy something off shelf. We have to get stuff made up that it's still as manual as possible to keep in line with the ethos of the business. And for me, that's the most important.
Who are your customers? I mean, where do you move biscuits?
Well, Purity is one of our large customers. So all the Purity baby products, the teething biscuits, the rusks and the biscotti, We also bake for Clicks under their own brand in retail. Also the Teething Biscuits. And there we won New Product Developer of the Year in year one that Very we started cool. supplying. And it was because we developed this new funky recipe that contains fruit and veg for babies. And then we launched a cereal bar. We launched a butternut rusk. You know, so it's a healthy alternative for the kids. And then also your Garden Courts, your Southern Suns, your Tsohosan hotels. Of late, we started supplying Sun International hotels, Protea hotels. So that's basically, and then also Syro. And I must say there, I'm very honored because that's the company I worked for before. And they were actually the first key client that said to us, we will support you because
Is Sarah Ann Orfanidi still running Syro?
Is
Sarah Ann Orfanidi still running Syro?
No.
No. Okay. Well, then she was there for a bit. I think she was. Yes. I think she was selling coffee for a bit at AVI. But I'm glad that you are getting that support. I mean, it's been critical in terms of being allowed to develop this business. So, how many biscuits a week are you baking?
Well, we can start with per day. We average at the moment 82,000 cookies in a day. 82,000.
Is that 5 days a week or is that?
Yes, seven? 5 days a week. So, on average, in a month.
Odd. A week, sure.
It's basically in a month we average about 1.6 million cookies that we put through the factory, each individually wrapped, single wrapped, hand packed, and baked.
You know, if you've got a machine, you could do like 10 times as many.
And that's actually what the engineers told us. Yeah. If I replace all my staff with a machine at this moment in time, we increase our output threefold per day, and I go down to 12 staff members. That's the sad reality of mechanization.
How,
but it's also needed.
How tempting is that for you?
I must say, at times like what we had in April, May, and June, we were down to using 3 ovens instead of our normal 11 ovens, and the debt just started piling up again. I was very tempted to do it. And it takes you every day to walk down when you feel despondent and you see the staff and you actually, you know, like speak to the staff. We realize, you know what? If I'm not going to do this and if I'm not going to push through, who's going to do that?
And then you've got
you?
this guy, Leviticus, who's been dead for 2,000 years, shouting in your ear.
Exactly.
What gives you the purpose? I mean, is it religious faith? Is it a sense that if you don't do it, no one else is going to do it, and we've got enough problems in the country as it is, so we've all got to pull
our weight? I would say it's a combination between passion and faith. And my passion is for children. I think if South Africans out there, and I do get emotional when I talk about this. Mm. If you've ever held a dying child in your arms, and the reason why that child dies is because they didn't have food.
Yeah.
It will change the outlook in your life completely. Mm-hmm. And I've been there numerous times. So every morning when I drive to work and I see people waiting next to the robots for work for their day, I know they used their last money to get there in the hope of finding a job today. And the reason why they want to do it is to put food on their tables.
There's no lack of desire. There is no lack of wanting to do the job. We just don't have the jobs. And tragically, so many people in quite a charged, politically charged, union-charged environment have opted.
Yes, union-charged, we know that.
have opted to go this route. Do you bash heads with unions?
Yeah, we do. We bashed heads with the union for quite often. So the FAO official in our area actually resigned after dealing with me. we fight the fight. And I think the unfortunate thing is they target the uneducated, unskilled staff members. And we find it more so in years that leads up to voting, you know, with empty promises. And, you know, like they don't give the staff the right detail and the truth at the end of the day. And remember, the unions, they function on fees. So they will tell the staff any given lie to actually get them to become members to end up with fees, and then it's the business owners who have to deal with unmet, unrealistic expectations. And so I bump heads with them quite a lot. We went through our first ever strike last year in 12 years, and it was heartbreaking. Well, it was gut-wrenching.
And this is important because a lot of people listening to us this evening will say, well, I would have mechanized by now. If people for whom I'm creating an opportunity are not wanting to share that opportunity, well, then, hey, has a machine that all it wants is a bit of electricity and oil occasionally.
Yes. And I must say, again, in the strike, both Eunice and myself, the strike really broke us emotionally. That much I can say. We prepared for it physically, but we never prepared for it emotionally. And when we worked through the strike, we looked at the staff members that didn't go on strike. And we realized we can focus on the negative that's happening outside, or we can focus on the people that we know we've changed, not only their lives by giving them a job, but by enriching people that they take responsibility, that cycle of dependency on grants and dependency and the entitlement that goes with, you know, like a lot of the stuff that we get from informal settlements of you owe me, was broken. And they would have literally given their lives for me and Eunice. And for me, that inspired me more than actually the staff that was striking outside. And I realized there when I looked in the factory the one night, you know what, this is why we've got this business. This is why we do what we do. You win some, you lose some. You can't change everybody. But the ones that we did manage to change is the ones that we live for.
Audrey Williams, a motivational and inspiring story. The co-owner, she bought the business. When are you going to pay your debt down? Because you paid a rand for the business, took 2.5 million rand of somebody else's debt. When does that disappear? When are you all clear?
So what we need to do is they allowed me 10 years to pay off the debt. We've already settled 880,000 rand of that debt.
You're a third of the way.
Third of the way, we've got 4 years left, so we really need to start hiring up.
What are you sitting here talking to me for? Go and bake.
Exactly, exactly.
Audrey Williams, co-owner of Khayelitsha Cookies, a lovely story.